It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 250 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This episode is a very special one, and it kicks off with my interview with Neil Adams, a name in comics that almost everybody knows about for his work on Batman, X-Men, Green Arrow, and many other characters. We chatted at the recent Tampa Bay Comic Con, and he shared some of his opinions about Marvel and DC, about what they're doing right and what they're doing wrong, and his recent work on Superman. He's got a lot of fascinating things to say, so be sure to listen. Then, because this is a special episode, I'm going back into the archives and playing one of my favorite interviews, and that's with Wendy Pini from ElfQuest. This interview first aired in episode 125, and a few months after it posted, Wendy paid me a real compliment by saying that this was one of the best interviews that she had when ElfQuest, the final quest, got started. So remember that this took place back at the beginning of the series. They're still going strong, and it's coming out from Dark Horse, so if you haven't gotten into ElfQuest, The Final Quest, I still highly recommend it. In episode 250, there's a lot to get to, so let's get on with the show. Talking right now with Neil Adams, legendary comics creator, and who has recently done some Superman work. So how are you doing today, Neil?
I'm doing great. I've done 6 issues of Superman. I guess it's Superman and a few additional Supermen. And, of course, Jack Kirby characters, which I love to do. And I couldn't get them all in, but I got an awful lot of them in. You know, and in fact, we're missing Commandy, but I'm doing a Commandy issue for DC Comics. They're doing a run of Commandy. And I'm doing the second book.
Very good.
Let everybody try to match that second book.
So how did the coming of the Superman miniseries go? It was, what, 6 issues?
6 issues, and they're going to collect it in a graphic novel. I had done Batman Odyssey, and since I hadn't been around a while, I forgot about the Internet. I didn't realize the Internet had such horrible monsters on it. But I actually did. You know, I have a science thing where I talk about growing Earth and things. And if anybody comes at me on that, I've got like 12 videos, I cut them a new one. And for whatever reason, I forgot. I listened to advice. And when I had Batman Odyssey out, folks attacked it on issue 1 and issue 2 and got all uppity on me. And I didn't answer because I asked around and I said, well, should I say anything to these people? And they said, no, ignore them. That was the worst piece of advice I've ever gotten in my life. You cannot ignore those people. They are rabid and awful people. And, of course, my first response would have been, well, wait a second. You pick up a Stephen King novel and read one chapter and understand it? I don't think you do. And if you're going to say something about it, how about the whole thing come out and then you say it? Wait till you read it. Isn't that a good idea? I didn't get to say that, but with the Superman story, DC Comics realized that this was going on, and so they got behind it right away. They didn't get behind Batman Odyssey because they were doing 52. So we really didn't have any time for side issues. So it sort of came out, and of course the books are selling well now, the collections are selling well now, and they put it in the big Batman Odyssey, which is great because I get more royalties. So they got behind it, so everybody was really nice. They read it carefully, and they read it slowly, and they appreciate Jack Kirby, I think, as much as I did. And then I planted a seed right in the 6th issue that would make them want to get more issues. So we'll see what happens. I mean, I also did a little bit of a turn on Superman there where I think with modern science fiction, it's time for a little bit of a change in the world of Superman. And maybe the idea that Superman is from a civilization that came from Earth originally, who is a human, then we can get rid of this idea that Superman is an alien. but he is a evolved human, and maybe we can accept sex with Lois Lane. I'm just saying, yeah. It's always seemed a little harsh to me that it's one thing to start a story like Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster did, where everything is new and everything is wonderful, and nobody really cares about consequences, and so you have a character from another planet. Nowadays, we're too into the science of creatures from another planet. You know, we've seen Star Wars, and we've seen science reports about all the planets that are out there, so we want more serious answers. So I think this little evolutionary stage is very good for Superman. And so we'll see what happens.
Well, I enjoyed it. I thought the end was a really good cliffhanger there. And, of course, it's called Coming of the Superman, so, you know, that implies there's something else to go. Sales did real well, and it turned out real nicely. Do you like to write and draw, or do you prefer...
I like to write and draw more than anything. I like that. I hate to say this, because I'm... Okay, this is going to sound like ego, so I withdraw the ego part of it, and I would say that it's a rationale. Okay, I just happen to be a good artist, incidentally. I am a good writer, okay, and I've written a lot of stuff in different areas, advertising, commercial comics, regular comics. I wrote three of the four Spectres that I did. I wrote most of the Deadmans that I did. I really wrote most of Superman versus Muhammad Ali because Denny had to bow out. So I've done a lot of writing. It's just that people notice my art. I mean, if you're going to talk about Neil Adams, what are you going to talk about? You're going to talk about his artwork. Well, people ought to adjust that and say, well, wait a second. Yeah, I'll talk about his artwork, but I'll talk about his storytelling within the artwork. And then you start to realize, oh, maybe an artist isn't an artist just because he draws a pretty picture. Maybe he's a good comic book artist because he's a good storyteller. And I'm a good storyteller. Well, if I'm a good storyteller, the chances are pretty good I'm going to be a pretty good writer. Okay. And that's what I like to do. Batman Odyssey is written entirely by me. Superman is written entirely by me. And Deadman was popular because I stopped the trend toward doing what at that time was Deadman stories. There's a bad thing that happens in comic books. As soon as you have a title like Deadman, there's a tendency to write The Adventures of Deadman. That's not what Deadman was about. Deadman was about Deadman. It was not about stories that he had with other people. That's why when any time anybody picked up to do Deadman, they would do Deadman and his adventures with other people. That's not what it's about. It's his terrible life story or death story or life story. Mm-hmm. And if it's not about him, you really just don't care because he's dead. Who really cares? You want to know what his torment is and what his resolutions are and how it works. When I did the original Deadman series, people were coming in with stories about Deadman faces blah, 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 or does this, or whatever. And I went to my editor and I said, look, I'm getting these plots in that don't make any sense. This book is about Deadman. It should only be about Deadman. And that's so he let me write it. And I wrote it about Deadman. It became a really popular series. But it was about Deadman. It's about Deadman's story. It's as if you wrote a book, a long book, about his life story. That's what it's about. So different books have a different tenor, okay? Batman is, in my opinion, a particular kind of book. Superman, in my opinion, is a particular kind of book. Deadman certainly is a particular kind of book. It's sort of like when the Marvel people are now doing movies. We can say, and we all pretty much agree, that certainly the Marvel movies are better than the DC movies. There's just no way to avoid that conclusion. And then we come to the second conclusion. That's because the Marvel people are reading the comic books, and they're following the comic books, and the DC people who was ever doing the DC movies are not. They don't know that Superman is a creature of the daytime while Batman is a creature of the night. And so they've made Superman into a creature of the nighttime. He's dark and dour all the time, doesn't even smile. Whose idea was that? Well, that was somebody who decided that the comic books just weren't good enough. Okay, we'll do our own Superman. No, you don't get to do that. But the people at Marvel, they've learned that lesson. They know their characters, and they know the characters that are in the books are in the movies. So they get it. The difficulty is that it's very hard to live in a world, the DC world, where they change all the time. You want them to be the same. And what I did with Batman was I created a great detective story. What I did with Superman is I created a great Superman story, very light, very airy, kind of, you know, flying from planet to planet and doing all this kind of stuff. That's what I prefer DC do. They stick to their characters. Their characters are interesting. They should stick to them, but they don't. So we're running into a problem. That Marvel Comics is already solved. I forgot the trend of my question.
I wanted to mention, too, because you talked about the fact that, like, Superman, all these characters are dark. DC's now, with this Rebirth series, trying to move away from some of the darkness. So your Superman series fits right in with that, because you're doing a brighter,
a more optimistic
Superman.
Right, daytime Superman, yes. No, I think it does. No, I don't want to say that DC may have taken a clue, but, you know, people do read my stuff. And people do look at it, and then people go, yeah, well, he's right about that. And I don't want to say that it's responsible in any way, but I think that they're a little bit on a better note now, and I think, and I like that they're following their characters a little bit more. I didn't like the 52. It was just chaotic. So I like what they're doing. I would like them to do it more, because I like their characters to be their characters. But, you know, you get used to a character, then it's sort of like Sherlock Holmes. You don't want Sherlock Holmes to be the Punisher. You know, you want him to be Sherlock Holmes. You want Punisher can be the Punisher. You know, that's fine for those people who like that stuff. I personally don't. Okay. But I don't want him to be Sherlock Holmes all of a sudden, and I don't want Sherlock Holmes to be the Punisher. I think they're very clear demarcations, and we should pay attention to that when we're doing the stories. And the writers, you know, I don't know what supervision they're getting quite at DC, but I think that I'm hoping that it'll settle down to writing the characters as the characters, not as somebody else's version of the characters. It's very annoying to see these guys make these movies and for them to decide what these characters should be and to give somebody, a character like Superman, even more power. I remember even in the first Superman movie, much as I may have liked it, okay, and it was a relief to get a Superman that seemed like a Superman, to have him jump out of a window and go down and have his clothes magically transform into a Superman outfit. What power is that? The power of transforming your clothes? And then to go around the world and have the time go backwards? Another superpower that not even Superman could have? That is not even possible. How about just explaining flying? You know, come up with some kind of a rationale for flying, because there's no such thing. Hello, maybe he can leap and maybe he can levitate, so explain it that way, you know, but flying around the world and have time go backwards? Sorry. That is just totally wrong. It's a wrong way to take the characters. And they have enough powers. I mean, one of the things that's so much fun about Batman is he has no powers. So you're dealing with a very strong Sherlock Holmes. And it's a lot easier to deal with until you start giving him powers, which is annoying. So I think that we should deal with our characters as they are, because they're more fun. They're much more fun.
Now, of course, another character you're associated with is doing real well on the television, and that's Green Arrow, on the Arrow show.
We call it the Neil Adams show.
Well, you know, I was going to say that the farther it goes along, the more it reminds me of the stuff that you've done with Green Arrow.
If you really look at it, except for the fact that he doesn't smile enough, and he ought to smile more, because he is like a sort of based on the Robin Hood of Errol Flynn, you know, a devil-may-care kind of smiley guy, smile-at-the-wrong-time kind of character. Outside of that, they're doing a really good job. And what they are doing is they're borrowing from Maya and Denny O'Neill stuff in Batman and in Deadman. I mean, in Deadman, I created League of Assassins. Okay? In Deadman, I created Nanda Parbat. In Batman, of course, we had the duel in the desert, which turned out to be a duel on the mountain with shirts off and swords. Why is Green Arrow fighting with a sword? I don't know. Doesn't he have a bow and arrow? No, we wanted to just do that sword fight in the desert. So that turned into a very big internet laugh, you know, or a joke on, if you're going to follow Neil Adams stuff, you might as well take it right out the window. And they're very happy to do that, and they're having a great deal of fun doing it, and they make fun with it. But the truth of the matter is that they've hooked into something really, really strong. And, you know, I hear criticisms of that show, but I hear everybody's watching it. It's sort of like the Gotham show. You got to watch it. The thing is about those guys is they're very big fans. They are fans, and they would not. You can tell they're fans. If you're going to pull up Nanda Parbat out of your tush, right, you got to know that Neil Adams stuff, because that's just in Dead Man. So they're following the stuff, and they're doing it, and they're doing a decent job of it. So I'm very happy with all of that.
That's good. Now, you did stuff for Marvel, too. You recently did a miniseries not that long ago. We did one with Christos Gage a while back, with X-Men kind of a thing.
Yeah. I did it, and Christos Gage did a nice job, but I wasn't really happy with Marvel editorial. I think that Marvel editorial got very heavy-handed. I handed in a really good story, and I can tell you a little bit about it. I had one character at the end And it was about X-Men before there were X-Men, about Wolverine collecting mutants together and trying to be their leader, and of course failing because he's not like Professor X, an intellectual guy, but a warrior. And if you take young teenagers out to fight, they will die. Not a good thing. Anyway, they were gathering together what seemed like mutants. And in the story, in the original story, they found a kid who looked sort of like a gray. You know what a gray is? Tell me what a gray is.
Why don't you go ahead and tell us what it is?
Okay. A gray is those little aliens, little naked aliens that are about 3.5 feet tall, and they're skinny, and they have these big eyes, big almond eyes. And this kid was born who looked very much like a gray. And so they're collecting mutants, and he has certain abilities. So they want to bring him into the what is now becoming the new X-Men. And he's saying that he's not a mutant, but that he's the left back child of aliens, that he's a gray. And he doesn't really want to join the mutants. On the other hand, they're the only people who will take him in because he's so alienated. Anyway, the crux of the story, as we're moving forward in the story and we're getting to the end of the story, it gets very dramatic, and you know, the X-Men are not doing so well. And then at a certain point, sort of to save them, this spaceship comes down, and sure enough, it's loaded with grays, and they come out, and this kid, you know, runs to them to finally meet his real parents, and they stop him, and they say, "Dude, you're not one of us. You have nothing to do with us. You just kind of look like us, but no, you're not." And it's a terrible, tragic moment where you see him just morally crumble, and it's a terribly dramatic moment. And then, of course, all shit breaks loose and all kinds of stuff happened. But it was a terrific piece of drama, okay? Well, editorially said, well, X-Men does mutants. They don't do aliens. So they can't be an alien. And I said, well, wait a second. What about the Shahari? And well, they said, no. Editorially, we decided that Avengers do aliens and X-Men do mutants. Pulled the legs right out from under my story. Destroyed the story. I went ahead and did the story, and then they gave me a writer to dialogue the story named Christos Gage, and then he stepped in further under instruction to help to write it. It wasn't any help because it didn't follow the story, and it just sort of crumbled apart as we went toward the end. It's like, well, I don't think I want to do this anymore. It's not any fun. I don't understand that kind of editing. I don't understand that approach. And considering that I was accepted into Marvel as the writer, why I got another writer, good as he is, I didn't understand. It didn't make any sense to me. So it was an unhappy experience, and it's one of those things I will never repeat. That's never going to happen to me again. That story, the meat of that story, is left lying in the driveway, and nobody gets to read it.
We should hang on to it. You can probably use that somewhere else down the road.
I don't know. It's a hard one to use, but you know, maybe if I get the opportunity, I certainly will use it. Wouldn't you say a great piece of drama?
Oh, yeah. Sounds great.
Oh, my God.
One last question. What projects are you working on that we can look forward to?
I'm working on a Superman Harley Quinn story where Harley Quinn is it's based on the Superman versus Muhammad Ali story. It's sort of a takeoff. So I'm finishing that up like probably the end of the week. And I'm working on a Commandy story, the second story in the run. And then hopefully I'll be doing, well, I don't want to say what I'm going to be doing because that would be telling you.
Well, we should just keep our ears to the ground.
Yeah.
Do you have a website or something? How do people keep up with
things? NeilAdams.com. If you can remember my name, it's not hard to get it. .com. Very easy to keep up with me and know where I'm going, what I'm doing. I have no secrets. I don't hide away from anybody. Anybody, Neil Adams, if you know my name, you can find me.
Well, we're talking at the Tampa Bay Comic Con, and it's great to see you interacting with fans and enjoying.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
Imagine another world, much like Earth, but primitive, wild, and uncivilized. A world of prehistoric beasts and cave-dwelling humans. A world where each day is a test of survival. and where the night belongs to the Wolf Riders. Deep in the primeval forest they dwell, a small tribe of elves whose only friends are a pack of wolves. Every night they ride forth to hunt and howl, terrifying any superstitious human who dares cross their path. But all is not as it appears, for the Wolf Riders, like wolves, are really gentle and shy, a close-knit family group living in harmony with nature. Led by their dashing chief, Bearclaw, they fight only when they must to protect their hidden forest home and their loved ones.
It's a real honor and a pleasure to welcome to the podcast Wendy Peeney, the co-creator and artist for ElfQuest, a comic that I have enjoyed for years, and I'm so glad I'm getting to enjoy it again. How are you doing today, Wendy?
I'm doing just terrific, and just let me add a little bit to your introduction. I am the artist of ElfQuest, and I'm also the writer. Richard and I co-create the stories, but I actually write the scripts.
Oh, wow. Well, that's great. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I saw him as a co-creator, so I kind of assumed he had something to do with the writing. I guess he has some.
Richard has a lot to do with the writing, but it is more in the area of what he contributes to the story. And then he does a lot of editing work and helps to really craft the script once it's written.
Oh, wow. That's neat.
Yeah.
That's great. Now, the first thing I want to say is that I've always loved the way that you portray the characters. I always feel like the elves are what we wish we were, mm-hmm. and the humans are who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And I always think that's something that always fascinates me, because so often elves are kind of mean and nasty, and you know, you see them and they've got long pointed ears and long teeth and nails and stuff, but they actually are really human characters, and that's one of the things that's grabbed me from the very beginning. I'll tell you a real quick story about how I got into ElfQuest. My brother, who was into comics as well, he was living in a different place in the country where I was at the time. And so what happened was he sent me the four color trades, those bigger trades, and I sat down one night and got into them, and man, it was the morning before I knew it. And I was it was so great. You know, one of the ones that I remember the most is when Cutter gets to drink what is like alcohol.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
That was a wonderful little bit. You know, he's standing there, and all of a sudden he slowly starts to go down under the table. Which I...
A lot of people could relate to that.
It was so wonderful. And from then on, I've been buying the book. And when the new series came out, I was really happy about it. You know, I'm thinking there's a lot of people who may never have been exposed to ElfQuest at this point. Do you want to give a little bit of the history of how it came to be?
All right, just very quickly, in 1977, there was kind of a boom in fantasy and science fiction, what was Star Wars and Ralph Bakshi's Lord of the Rings, and there was just a real strong interest in heroic fantasy. And also at the same time, the independent comics movement was just starting to get off the ground. There were maybe two or three titles. So I sat Richard down and I told him the story that I had in mind of ElfQuest, which is something I had on my mind for a long, long time. I had been drawing elves or elf-like characters literally almost all my life. And so the timing seemed right to bring out a story like that in 1977. And Richard took to it right away. And we asked around, we knocked on Marvel and DC's doors, and they thought what we had was too peculiar. So they didn't want to, you know, first of all, it was black and white. It was magazine size. It was written and drawn by a woman and influenced by Japanese anime and manga, which very few people had ever heard of at the time. So it ElfQuest had a lot going against it. And to make a long story short, because there were a number of adventures and turns in the road along the way, we finally decided to publish it ourselves. And ElfQuest's beginnings owes, 99% of its life to Richard just learning by the seat of his pants how to become a publisher. And managed to get our first issue out. It had been previously released by another independent company that was less than reliable, shall we say, but we managed to get all the artwork back, and then we re-released our first issue ourselves, and mm-hmm. just took off from there. I also want to give credit to Phil Suling on the East Coast and Bud Plant on the West Coast, two friends of ours. They were two distributors the big two comics distributors at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them knew me from my earlier career as a science fiction illustrator, and they trusted that. So they took a huge order from us. Between the two of them, they took 10,000 comics, which was unheard of for independent comics in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing sold out within months.
Mm-hmm.
So we were on our way really, really fast. And the rest is history, shall we say.
Because it's been interesting, the evolution of the book. You know, you're right, it started out black and white, then color versions came out, and then, well, now you're doing color all the time, it seems like. And I'm that's a good thing, I think, because the black and white, while it's entertaining, in some circumstances it works real well. To me, the coloring and the way that the coloring is done just adds to the tone and the mood of the book and makes it enjoyable. I really love the color because it just seems to add something special to the book, the way that it's colored. And you've been doing color now for quite a while.
Yes.
What's it like to have the color involved with it?
Well, you see, back in the early 80s, the first publisher we worked with, Dawning Starblaze, collected the comics from the first 21 issues and brought out four large volumes that they wanted to be in color. And it was tough going at first because they didn't want to really invest in high quality materials. So myself and my assistant colorists, you know, struggled with what materials we had, and I wasn't altogether satisfied with the Dawning Starblaze volumes. Nevertheless, they sold like hotcakes. And after that, at any time that we could, we evolved ElfQuest. We would always bring it out in black and white first and then get a second life out of each release in color.
Mm-hmm.
We worked with Marvel Comics, and they recolored the first four volumes of ElfQuest in their way. And then onward from there, we worked with an animation studio called Chelsea Animation.
Mm-hmm.
Colored Siege at Blue Mountain and Kings of the Broken Wheel for us. And I think ElfQuest has always been associated with color, even though it is always done in black and white first. And that's the process we're even using today with the Dark Horse series, ElfQuest, The Final Quest.
Mm-hmm.
Dark Horse is certainly releasing ElfQuest in color now as a bi-monthly series.
Mm-hmm.
And those will be collected and put into color volumes at some point. But Dark Horse is also working with us on re-releasing everything we've ever done in black and white.
So
fans of black and white will be able to have what they want, and people who prefer color are certainly going to get that too.
Wow, I didn't know that. You're going to re-release the stuff in black and white. That'd be fun. It'd be nice to have it both ways because, you know, the color adds a little something to it, but the black and white is a very powerful medium in its own.
Absolutely. We do have fans who actually prefer the black and white. There are fans who do not like the digital coloring that I or Sunny Strait do, and there are others who just worship the color and kind of poo-poo the black and white. So we try to please everybody if we can.
Well, you're doing a great job of it, I think, because, man, even though you've been, like, as I count now, you've been with DC and been with Marvel, and now you're with Dark Horse, and you've done with other independent publishers.
Yes.
No matter where you guys go, you always put out a quality product, and I think that's just a wonderful, you know, testament to ElfQuest, is that you guys just always want the best and give us the best as fans.
Well, we really do bust butt on ElfQuest because it has certain things it requires. It's a rather elaborate kind of drawing style that you don't really see in other comics. I guess because ElfQuest is high fantasy, the drawing style is very organic, and the fans do appreciate a lot of detail. They expect the characters to always look like themselves in every panel.
Mm-hmm.
So we work really hard to keep the characters on model.
Mm-hmm.
And we just pay a lot of attention to detail in the costumes, the scenery, the settings, so that it has a kind of a heightened reality about it. When you're working with a fantasy, it's really important that you're absolutely committed to the reality of it, even if it is just a fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And the more committed you are, the more your audience is going to believe it.
It was interesting you mentioned that, because I was going to say, to me, these characters are not fiction. They are real.
Oh,
I always feel so great about that because I feel like I know these people. You know, they're actual people, and if I actually found the right place, I would be there with these people. And you're kind of telling the stories as you see them, you know, but
yes.
they're very real. And I, you know, not many comics do that to me. And I think this is one of the things that makes it sing to me and so many other people, is that they're not just cardboard characters. You know,
we
talk.
Not at all.
Yeah, we talk a little bit about the fact that we saw Cutter getting, you know, tasting alcohol for the first time and things. There are experiences that they go through that we can relate to, and that's one of the things that makes ElfQuest just shine to me is that – and that's why I was so thrilled when I saw that Dark Horse was going to put out a new series. So, man, I get to go back and visit my friends again.
Us too. You know, we actually started the Final Quest before we closed our deal with Dark Horse. We were going to get it out there one way or another, even if we just started by putting it up online first and finding a publisher later on. We just trusted that would come, but we knew we had to finish telling the story. So we started putting the Final Quest up online with the first 26 pages of the special, the Final Quest special, which was kind of a reintroduction to the story that would enable new readers to sort of come into the universe and get acquainted with it, and would enable longtime readers to reacquaint themselves with where the story was going and where it had been. And we made a wonderful arrangement with the online news service Boing Boing that has some major ElfQuest fans there. And we were very surprised to find that out, given how sophisticated Boing Boing is. But but it just so happened that it was a wonderful partnership, and getting a page up on Boing Boing at intervals really got the fans excited about the new series coming.
Well, I got to tell you, as soon as I saw it, I went, oh, man, I've got to have that. So it was just so great because, you know, it'd been like a little bit since I'd seen him. You know, this leads to a question. You have an interesting, I don't know if it's a problem or not, but it's something different than, say, other or some comics maybe, like Batman, who's been around for decades and stuff. But with ElfQuest, you've told a lot of story over time.
Yeah.
And yet I still find that, like, the final quest coming, it's just as, you know, as engaging. And I don't think you need to know everything in order to be able to read it, but it definitely helps. Do you find it difficult between, like, new fans and older fans to tell the story, or do you have to always think about everybody at that point?
Well, no, we don't ever sacrifice the telling of the story for the purposes of you know, making sure that every single person is caught up on every detail. That way madness lies. What we tried to do in the Final Quest special, which came out last October from Dark Horse, was to tell a story. This is a story that covers some three decades in the elves' lives. And over that period of time, some are born, some die, and events start to shape themselves into the precursor of the actual Final Quest series storyline. So it was a delicate balancing act to do. Richard and I really, really paid attention to keeping the story moving, even as we were, filling in gaps and reintroducing the readers to these characters. You don't just stop dead in the middle of a scene and announce who a character is or what they did. You try to weave that character's history into the scene and have it make sense to the reader. I think we were successful, at least based on the fan reaction. The older readers were very pleased with the story, and newer readers were very intrigued.
Because I was just going to ask you that question. What's the response been? You're not hearing negative stuff. I think what's going to happen is everybody's going to like it. They're just going to see it different, slightly different ways than what they've seen in the past, let's say.
Well, the reviews of Final Quest number 1, which came out in January, were just stellar. We had never seen reviews like that before, or attention like that paid to ElfQuest. I think we owe a lot to Dark Horse in that regard. They have a marvelous publicity department, and they're very marketing savvy, unlike other comics publishers that we've worked with, who really didn't have their marketing act together. But I think Dark Horse gets us in a way that Marvel and DC didn't, because Dark Horse, you know, it very much started out like we did, as a scrabbly independent, you know, making its way up against the big two. Mm-hmm. And so Dark Horse understands us and understands what ElfQuest is and how to market it. And I think that is being reflected in the attention that it's getting right now. And we're so pleased with that. I can't tell you how pleased.
Well, I'm proud to say I wrote one of those reviews, and I gave it stellar marks, because to me, having it back again was like, you know, like you're with family again. You know, you get to visit family you haven't seen in a long time, and there you are talking with them and stuff. I just loved it. And I got a lot of positive response to my review, too.
Yes.
Some people who had never seen it were writing me, you know, personally and saying, wow, I didn't know this existed. And I would say, get the trades, get whatever you can, you know, catch up on it as best you can.
Well, thank you so much for that support. I remember the review. And again, we really, really appreciated it. I'm going to apologize to you in advance, though. We are going to be doing some awful things in Final Quest, just awful.
Okay.
One of our formulas for storytelling is to think of the worst thing that could possibly happen to the characters and then go ahead and do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I hate to tell you, but real life feels like that sometimes, that somebody's out there thinking of the worst thing they can possibly do to us, and then they go right ahead and do it, you know. So to me, there's a real, as I said before, there's a real feel to this that is, it just makes me want to just, I wish I could sit down amongst them and listen to them talk, you know. It would be just the greatest thing in the world. Now, as far as, you know, have you gotten a lot of response from new people who have never heard of it before?
Well, that's the wonderful thing about the internet, because, you know, I've only really been internet savvy for about, 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And Facebook is an amazing thing. It's an amazing tool. It can be infuriating at times, but it certainly helps you to generate awareness if you have something going on that you want people to know about.
Mm-hmm.
So Richard and I are now overseeing 3 ElfQuest-related Facebook pages. We each have our own personal pages. Mm-hmm. And then there is an ElfQuest fan page and the official ElfQuest page. So there's actually 4. And, you know,
wow.
every day we come up with something and we share it over to the various pages just to, you know, let the fans know what's going on and to keep them interested. And it often generates just miles and miles of commentary if something, you know, slightly controversial comes up. And the controversy is always good, too. It mm-hmm. really gets people talking.
Mm-hmm. There's a guy I know named David Peterson. I don't know if you heard of Mouse Guard. He does that, and the thing he says is because it takes him, so he does the whole package. Everything is his thing, and so it takes him a while to get it. And, of course, he uses a different size, too, than the regular comics are, and so that takes him a long time.
Yeah.
And when I interviewed him, he said one thing. What he does is every once in a while he does something on social media just to let people know that he hadn't died. They hadn't heard from him in a long time, and they wanted to know what he was doing, and so he occasionally does this stuff just to let them know, I am still working on it. Yes, I am.
Uh-huh.
So I find that interesting. There are going to be the Luddites out there who are going to just say, well, this sucks, this is no good, and not give you any sort of constructive criticism. So, I mean, I get that too, believe it or not. But the thing to me is that, in a way, I think that the internet is a great big help, because you get to understand what people are thinking out here. And, of course, nobody really represents the whole audience. You're going to get different snapshots.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the first pieces of feedback we got from somebody when the first issue of Final Quest came out was that they wanted their money back.
Oh.
But,
oh.
But you see, you know, Richard and I have a phrase that we really love, praise and blame all the same. You know, it really doesn't matter. I mean, we're at a point in our lives where if someone just doesn't feel comfortable with what we're doing and they let us know in no uncertain terms, we just say, okay, live and be well. You know, maybe leave if you like. Maybe you'll come back later on and check it out again. And the wonderful thing is when some people do, we've actually had people leave because they're, you know, tired of it or whatever. And we do expect that. ElfQuest has been such a long-running series that we are in no way so unrealistic as to expect people to follow us for the full 35 years.
Wow.
We do have fans like that, but we're not surprised in the least when someone tells us, oh, you know, I went to college or I got married and I just dropped away from ElfQuest and I haven't seen it in 10 years or whatever. And then they find our Facebook pages and they let us know that, and they come back into the fold and they get all excited all over again. And one of the most brilliant moves Richard ever made was on ElfQuest's 30th anniversary back in 2008. He decided that we should put everything that we had ever published online up to that date for free.
Wow.
For the fans to catch up on the story, because at that time ElfQuest had been optioned by Warner Brothers, and Warner Brothers politely but firmly let us know that they didn't want us doing anything with ElfQuest while it was under option. So Richard thought, well, that means for however long Warner Brothers has it, ElfQuest is going to be off the shelves and out of people's radar. Mm-hmm. So let's put it up. Let's put what we have up online for free so people can stay caught up on the story. It was a brilliant move. It got us, I think, hundreds, if not thousands, of new readers.
Wow.
And just completely revived ElfQuest without it ever having to be on the shelves for those 4 years.
Wow. Well, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so interesting because, you know, the debate now, of course, in comics is digital versus print.
Yes.
You know, what are you going to do? Are you going to go digital? And some people say that the screen's on, like, on my iPad. I buy digital copies of things, too.
Yes.
The color will be a little different on the screen than it will be on the paper.
Absolutely.
But I'm still enough of an old fan, old style fan, that I'd like to have the paper copy.
Most fans do, and I think particularly readers of fantasy do. I would say a large majority of ElfQuest fans, and there are hundreds of thousands out there, let us know that they like to be able to hold the book in their hands and smell the fresh ink and have that experience you know, of waiting for the comic to come out and then finding it at their store. And Richard and I fully understand that. Richard even more than I, because he's such a bibliophile. Mm-hmm. I'm a digital person. I tend to be somewhat futuristic in my thinking, and I love looking at stuff online or reading it on paper. It doesn't make any never mind to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, different strokes for different folks.
Yeah, as long as they're reading it, that it doesn't matter to me how people are reading it,
yeah.
as far as that goes. But do you actually, are you using, like, Photoshop and things like that to create the artwork these days?
Absolutely. In fact, entirely. I use a Wacom Cintiq, which is a marvelous digital drawing tablet. It's large. It's I think it's got about a 25-inch width. And this is something that animators have been using for a long time to do digital animation and even regular 2D animation cells. Mm-hmm. And I remember first seeing them when I visited an animator friend at Warner Brothers and getting very excited about it. And he let me play with it. And just being able to apply the stylus to the screen and be able to make a lovely, clean line just got me really excited. So when I was able to get my own Cintiq, I taught myself to work digitally. And as I said, I've been doing so since around 2002 or 2003.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that you have the wonderful, blessed undo button, which I, to this day, I love.
You know it. I mean, I'll see fabulous artists like Mike Mignola or Walt Simonson in my newsfeed, and they'll be talking about, oh, you know, I had a problem with this page, so I had to throw it out and start over again. And I often message them and say, have you ever worked digitally? Because it's so forgiving.
Mm-hmm.
You have that marvelous history function that you can go back through. So if you mess up, mm-hmm. you just go back through history and claim what you did before you messed up.
That's right. I think even I don't do the intricate stuff I'm sure that you do, but if I do something, I go, whoops, I don't want that, and I undo, and I get to start try something again.
Exactly so. It's very forgiving, and I often think it actually makes your creativity a little more spontaneous, because sometimes mistakes that you make lead you to realize what you wanted to do originally.
Yeah.
And if you can quickly go back through the history of your mistake and get rid of it and then do what you wanted to do originally, it makes the work better, in my opinion.
Yeah. Very true. Now, you mentioned earlier that, Warner Brothers had a light.
Yes.
Has that expired? Is that why the books are coming out now?
Yeah. Okay. ElfQuest was with Warner Brothers for 4 years, and they finally passed on it. They gave us the excuse that it was too much like The Hobbit, which means they never read it. They never read what they had.
Yeah.
But this is the way the big studios work. They often buy up a lot of properties and hang on to them just in case they want them. And then they let them go. So we're quite used to that. I mean, ElfQuest has been optioned more times since 94. It's been optioned many times in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And the option money is always nice. And, mm-hmm. and we always try to get as far as we can get with the movie. But it's never quite... Richard likes to say we've been up to the altar many times, but never quite got married. You know what? I have to say right now that my personal belief, and I guess this is kind of spiritual, is that when the time is right for something, it happens. And so I believe that we've kind of been somehow protected by guardian angels over the years, and that rather than have a bad ElfQuest movie or even a mediocre one come out, we've just gone through the system and will continue to do so until the absolute right entity comes along to do the absolute right ElfQuest movie. So we're not really worried. We just keep expecting the right one to come along eventually.
Well, I'm sure you've heard in the past that the animated versions of ElfQuest would be really interesting. If they followed your art style, to see that on the screen would be just a wonderful thing. So
that's what we would prefer more than anything, because, as you said a little while back, the characters are people, mm-hmm. and they're very strong individuals, and each character has a really strong personal look to them. And it would be wonderful if animators, whether it be 2D or 3D CGI, could capture the look of the actual drawing style. That would be wonderful.
Mm. Well, that's what I'd like to see anyway. That's just my thought. So, well, why don't...
From your mouth to the gods of animation's ear.
So, well, why don't we talk a little bit about the characters? Because,
sure.
You know, Cutter to me has been a wonderful character ever since the start. Now, I like that they have soul names,
yes.
that their friends will know their soul names if they have this attachment to them close enough.
Yes.
I always like that kind of, and it's not just male, female. It'll be like Cutter and name escapes me right at the moment.
Skywise,
yeah, that they understood that. I
yeah.
kind of thought, you know, this was I talked a little bit about how this is the way we wish we were. I often thought that, you know, this kind of a friendship, you know, that some sex dominates too much in relationships, that friendship is more than just a sexual thing. And I always liked that about Skywise and Cutter, that they were very close on a spiritual level and friends. And I that was one of the things about ElfQuest I used to point out to people. I said that, yeah, there's sexual things going on, but, you know, there are relationships that are very close that are not necessarily sexually based.
That's absolutely right. Cutter and Skywise are as much soulmates as Cutter and Lita are. Lita is Cutter's life mate. They have two children, and they know it. Well, she knows Cutter's soul name. It's only the Wolf Riders that have soul names.
Mm.
The other elves don't, because it's only the Wolf Riders that are mortal. And so the soul names are a factor of their mortality. It's almost like a way of retaining a certain kind of personal integrity that the immortal elves don't seem to be concerned about. And so, yeah, so Cutter and Skywise are soul brothers, just mm-hmm. like he and Lita are life mates.
Mm-hmm. I like Lita, too, I have to say. She's you know,
pistol.
Well, what's funny is you know, Cutter is very light. He's got white hair and he's got yep. light-colored skin. And there's Lita, who is dark-colored skin, you know, and a much of a darker look to her, although she's the one that really seems to have much more of the light. This is the wonderful contrast about these things. Cutter is much more of the physical can do more active or violent things, while his soulmate, who is darker, is actually the light bringer of the bunch.
Well, I love you mentioning that, because we actually gave thought to that when we first created the characters. When the Wolf Riders are driven from their home in the very first story by fire, and they have to cross, they make a dreadful crossing of a desert, and they come upon the Sun Village, where they encounter for the first time ever another tribe of elves. They thought they were the only elves in the world, and then they meet the Sun Folk. And the Sun Folk, because they're desert people, are dark. But when the Wolf Riders first see them, Cutter says, well, I don't think they're elves. They remind me more of humans, and I don't trust them. So we wanted to play off the differences in cultures. And ElfQuest is never about good versus evil like most sword and sorcery is. There's always the evil bad guy and the good guy, and good must triumph over evil. We never tell stories like that. Our stories are always about knowledge versus ignorance. So when the Wolf Riders come and discover the Sun Village, they're in a state of ignorance about the fact that there are other elves in the world. And it's the Sun Villagers, dark-skinned and elegant as they are, that teach the Wolf Riders that there are other ways to behave and a little bit more civilized behavior. Lita has been a very civilizing factor in Cutter's life.
Well, isn't that true of real life, though, I have to say? It's kind of that. See, again, this is that real thing to me, that they are very real in how things go. Now, one of the things I've enjoyed about the new series is that Cutter's relationship to his daughter.
Yes.
It's so fascinating to me because she's kind of a chieftain, and much like he is.
Much like him, in the storyline called Shards, the Wolf Riders split up into two splinter tribes, and Cutter appointed Ember as chief of her splinter tribe of Wolf Riders, and they did this for survival reasons. And much like Cutter, much like her father, Ember became a chief too soon. She was very, very young, and she had to learn, like he did, by the seat of her pants. And now, more than ever, in the Final Quest storyline, she and her dad are going to be very, very close, because it's a tremendous learning experience to have to lead a tribe through trials and tribulations, and it makes you much stronger, and in a way, it takes away your innocence. So she and her father, who have both gone through that, will be closer than ever. The other child that Cutter has with Lita, his name is now Sunstream. It was Suntop, but as he became an adult, his name became Sunstream. He is the magical one. He is going to be the pilot of the Palace of the High Ones, which is an ancient vessel. Belongs to all the elves. And Cutter actually has a hard time relating to Sunstream, because all this magic and powerful spiritual stuff is quite foreign to him. Cutter is extremely down to earth. And, you know, he understands the way, which is the way of the Wolf Riders. And the palace is really starting to interfere with that. So that is the premise of the storyline of Final Quest, which is basically who goes home to the stars and who stays and why and what are going to be the consequences of that.
You know, I'm so looking forward to it, but I'm going to be so sorry when it happens. You know, because I've gotten so attached to these characters and what they're going through.
No, you won't, because look at it this way. We did our Future Quest stories in the 90s. We worked with other artists and writers and worked with the universe of ElfQuest in the future, way past the Wolf Riders. So you know there's a future to ElfQuest. So that means the story doesn't end with the Final Quest.
But I'm still going to miss these guys. I mean, you know, I'm...
Well, no! How do you think? Some are going to stay. You don't know who.
Okay. Now, this is a bi-monthly series going on. Apparently, you've had this conclusion in mind for a while.
For many, many years, at least since the mid-90s, if not earlier. Yeah.
So how many issues are going to be in the Final Quest?
Well, each volume is going to be 6 issues long, and each issue is 20 pages. So each volume will contain at least 120 pages of story, and then lots of extras and bonuses. And there's going to be, at the moment, it looks like there could be 4 volumes, but I will guarantee 3.
Okay.
There could be as many as 4.
Okay. Because, you know, also in this new series, there are new characters and
yes.
people we haven't seen before,
yes.
new elves and things like that. And I just, you know, to me, I just this world that you guys have developed is this huge blossoming thing that, you know, man, if for someday you finally decided you didn't want to do it anymore and somebody else could come along and pick it up and take the elements that you've laid down and create something amazing, you know, even if it wasn't you, but, you know, I'd rather you do it. But
well, without naming names, we're already talking to people who have ideas about what they want to do with certain characters once the final quest series concludes.
Wow.
And some of these ideas are really exciting.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Wow, that's really something. This is something, this amazing thing that you guys have created. It's just, it's astounding because, you know, I mean, you know, Batman's gone on for so many years, but a lot of the times you see the stories recycle.
Yes.
You know, but I don't see the stories recycling in ElfQuest. I see these people going in different places and different characters might experience the same thing, but that's real life. So to me, this burgeoning world of wonderful things is just, I don't ever want it to end.
Well, we had 10,000 years to cover. That leaves a lot of room for story. You know, these characters are extremely long-lived, and it's been an interesting challenge to make characters that are not human and, for all intent and purposes, immortal, to make them relatable. Mm-hmm. Because Richard and I both feel that there really is no point to telling a fantasy story unless it can say something about the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
And so we actually use the elves in the story to sort of make commentary on things that Richard and I feel are very important about society in general.
Well, you're doing a tremendous job, I have to say.
Thank you.
Now, are there other projects you're working on, or is the Final Quest going to keep you busy for a while?
Well, while ElfQuest was optioned by Warner Brothers, that left me with 4 years where I couldn't really do much with ElfQuest.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a side trip to the dark side with an adaptation of Edgar Allan Poe's Mask of the Red Death.
Oh, wow.
Now, this is a very adult-oriented, really way out there and really goes there horror story.
Mm.
Because not a lot of people know that I actually started out as a horror artist. Some of my earliest work, which is going to Columbia University, by the way, we donated the body of my work to Columbia University, and we're very, very honored that it's going to be archived there. Mm. Some of my earliest work was of the horror genre, and Edgar Allan Poe is my favorite horror author, and Mask of the Red Death was always my favorite of his stories. Even though it's a very short story, it's only 8 pages long, and there are really no characters in it. But the atmosphere, the mood he generated in this story stuck with me all my life. And so I thought, well, I'm going to use this as the skeleton, and I'm going to create characters for it. And I'm going to explore the dark side of human nature. ElfQuest is a work of light, as you pointed out. It's a very high-reaching kind of spiritual story where we try to show people treating each other as well as they can.
Mm-hmm.
But in Mask of the Red Death, I wanted to walk in the shadows and do a story about people behaving very badly indeed.
Mm. So that's coming out?
It's out. It's been out.
Oh, it is already out. So who printed it?
Well, I completed it in 2011. My original publisher was a manga publisher called Gokomi, and it was published as part of their yaoi line. I don't know if you know the term yaoi, but it refers to a Japanese term called boy's love.
Mm.
There is gay romance in the story.
Oh.
And so the first volume was published through Gokomi, which was the first third of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Then, unfortunately, Gokomi went under and all the rights reverted to us. So Warp Graphics, Father Tree Press, brought out the entire 400-page story after it was finished in 2011 as a large specialty volume.
Oh, wow. I'm going to have to find that book because I didn't even know it was out there.
Well, Mask without reading the book, you just go to maskoftheredeath.com, mm-hmm. put a dash between each word because we couldn't get the actual Mask of the Red Death name, so we had to have hyphens between each word. Mm-hmm. Maskoftheredeath.com, and you can read the story just like you can read ElfQuest. You can read Mask online for free.
Oh, wow.
But then you follow the information to actually buy the book.
Oh, wow. Guess where I'm going after I get done talking with you. That's going to be fun.
Okay. Gay romance. Not everybody is.
Well, you know, you all are doing a great job, and I think you're right that Dark Horse is really getting the word out about it, and I'm doing my best to let people know about it as well. Because I just love the book. I think it's a classic. It's been a classic ever since it came out.
Yes.
And it's only going to get to be more classic as we go along. Storytelling, to me, is a lost art. A lot of comics are being sold just to sell them and make money. You know, Marvel had a thing that had a little kid with a quarter, and they said, how can we help you get his last quarter? And I thought, you know, that's not what comics are supposed to be about. It's supposed to be storytelling and things. And I think ElfQuest is just the ideal. You can read it for a while. You can read, catch up on all the story, and you get a bigger picture.
Yes.
But ElfQuest is just this wonderful, tremendous story with, you know, people that breathe and characters that exist and you come to be attached to. And I, like I said, I hope it goes on forever. I just think it's a wonderful, you know, a wonderful comic story.
Well, in our relationship with Dark Horse, we feel that Dark Horse is treating us far better than any other publisher we ever worked with. We just love being with them. And they have many, many plans for ElfQuest, and they will certainly be reprinting all the material that we have to date and keeping those volumes out there as long as people are interested in buying them.
Well, I think you're going to find a lot of people are interested in those because, you know, I still have my original ones. But, you know, if I found another version that was kind of – that added something to it, was a little different than what I wanted, my old ones started to fall apart, I'd be after them in a heartbeat.
Well, we really loved the DC archives that came out. DC reprinted the first four volumes, and I completely recolored it and reformatted it, and those are definitive as far as I'm concerned in terms of the way I wanted them to look. So you might look online for the DC archives until Dark Horse puts out its own.
Because I think I have the first two of those.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if I have all four. I'm going to have to go after the other ones because I just got to have those. Every once in a while, I'm in the mood for a nice longer story, and I sit down and I open the book, and it's like Frank Miller said when he read the first Daredevil, he fell in.
Yes.
And that's what, to me, as I fall into the story and I completely forget what time it is and what else is going on. I'm just lost with these people, and it's just such a great thing. You all just do such a good thing, and I'm so glad you're continuing on. I just think it's terrific.
Well, we still love it. We love it very much, and we especially love working together. I think that's the biggest joy of it for Richard and me, is we just love to tell the stories together and have story conferences and figure stuff out and ask questions like, oh my, can we go there? And every time we ask ourselves, can we go there? We always do.
yeah. But that's good. I don't see much of that kind of storytelling, to be honest. You know, stretching the boundaries and moving things around and making characters grow and learn through these unusual experiences. I think that's the way storytelling should be.
Well, I think most companies are invested in their brand and their product, and that means, I mean, you can't really have Batman or Superman or even Spider-Man grow beyond a certain point because they're constantly having to relaunch them for the next generation of readers, and those kind of characters have to be true to their brand. With ElfQuest, we're not so much preoccupied with that, and the major theme of the stories has always been growth.
Mm-hmm. See, the irony to me is that the more you do that and don't worry about the thing growing, the more it grows. That's the ironic part to me. I just think that it's been so good talking with you, Wendy, and I continue to wish you and Richard and Dark Horse much success with this. I'm going to be supporting this as much as I can and letting people know about how terrific that ElfQuest is.
Well, this was a delightful interview. Thank you for all the interesting questions, and thank you for your really great spirit in supporting us.
And that's it for episode 250. Next week, we begin the next 250 and more with another great interview talking with another wonderful comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.